department today to talk around restorative justice and family reunification. And I'm taking it that Mr. Gaba and Ms. Houston will do the presentations. Am I correct in saying that? Okay? So we'll do both presentations and then we'll go into the question-answer comment session. Okay. All right? So over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gaba. You can start.
Good morning, honorable members, and thank you for the opportunity to come before the committee and make a presentation on restorative justice and family reunification. The outline of the presentation covers the definitions, the aims and objectives of restorative justice and family reunification, crime prevention and support, our strategic objective, policy and legislative framework, and then we go to the aims and objectives of restorative justice and family reunification. We cover reunification, reintegration, and then we focus on the project, especially those handled by NGOs, what we call transfer funding, and then the transfer budget for location and then constraints thereof. It is important that we are on one mind regarding the definition, and we get that from the Child Justice Act that defines restorative justice as an approach to justice that aims to involve the child, the offender, the victim, the families concerned, and community members to collectively identify and address harms, needs, and obligations through accepting responsibility, making restitution, taking measures to prevent a recurrence of the incident, and promote reconciliation. That's a mouthful definition. And then if we look back, we will say that the principles contained in that definition, they stem directly from the Constitution. Its preamble is very clear on the need for reconciliation, on the need to address divisions, and on the need to unite. This is exactly what restorative justice seeks to address. And also it recognizes the need for redress, the need to reconcile, the need to accept the responsibility for the harm done. That is the foundation of the Constitution. So it's a paradigm shift. It is important the definition for the simple reason that the stakeholders involved in restorative justice, right from the magistrate, all stakeholders, the police, the social workers, they must be of the same mind when it comes to restorative justice and move away from retributive justice and appreciate that the Constitution recognizes rights, the rights of the offenders, the rights of the victims. So that's why it's based on reconciliation. But the important thing here, central in this definition, is that the offender needs to take responsibility. The offender needs to appreciate the wrong done and the harm, the breach of peace, and be ready to actually to reconcile. Even in a situation when the victim is not yet in a position to do so. So that is the first step. It is also important was on this definition to actually appreciate that the law requires that all children arrested, they should be assessed. So that first step has the same significance as diagnosis in medicine. Because it is in that assessment that the probation officer, who is an expert in diagnosing the harm and what is actually troubling that child to have that sort of behavior. So it is very, very important that a robust assessment takes place so as to elicit from the child and be in a position to establish whether that child actually accepts responsibility. That is the first step. And that is the beginning of the restorative justice. And then it will continue right until reunification. When the child moves right up to the center, and that work continues right until the child is at home. So we move now from the definition to family reintegration, reunification. Again, the definition there is important to understand that unification is the reunification of family members who have been separated from their families due to various reasons. Now, this becomes important because the sort of families we're dealing with, the environment in which they live, their situation, the stressors on the family are the very same realities that will confront that child when that child goes back to the family. The child might be coming from a dysfunctional family. The child might be coming from a family in poverty. The child might be coming from a situation where there's gang violence and all those issues, all those social fears. But the centrality of the family in the restoration services consists in the fact that that is aptly captured by the social crime prevention strategy that states very clear that the family is the cradle of nature. So in reunification, so all these services end at reunification, be it family group conferencing, be it home-based supervision, they have to be arranged in a family context that locates the family at the center of providing the services. Right, we move now to the aims and objectives of restorative justice. Clearly, the restorative justice seeks justice by different means. It aims actually to resolve the conflict that has actually placed the offender and the victim at opposite sides. So it actually aims at righting the wrongs, but in a constructive manner, in a manner that seeks to, especially children, as the Child Justice Act clearly states, to divert them from the criminal justice system and to ensure that they are given a second chance to live as a constructive citizen. Family reunification is a crucial component of the reintegration and aftercare duties of services. Here the emphasis is on aftercare. That is the way the focus actually lies. Because without the support services, and also, what we need to bear in mind when we're dealing with these issues is actually these, in reality, are cost drivers. Because to actually render these services in a family context is quite expensive. Because it means that when we have to move these children, you require actually transport to move them. You travel long distances to achieve that. And then there are enormous challenges on the way. We'll get to that when we deal with challenges. Then what is actually our objective as a program? is to reduce recidivism through an effective probation service to all vulnerable children and adults by March 2020. Now, we reduce this recidivism by ensuring that, as I have alluded earlier on, that there is a robust assessment and that we develop a developmental plan for the child. Then they are referred to appropriate diversion programs that actually ensure that when they actually exit the program, they are actually well prepared to be reintegrated in society. So in that way, the theory informs us that the chances of reoffending there are reduced. The objective statement, the extent of recidivism and vulnerability to crime by providing psychosocial and statutory services to children, youth and adults within the criminal justice process. We are looking at 19,040 beneficiaries. That is in terms of 2018-2019. This is what we are looking to achieve. When we work in a cluster, that's why we emphasize in the definition that it is important that we are of the same mind in terms of the definition. Why? If the magistrate, for example, in issuing a diversion order, fails to state the implications of not adhering to the order of the child, immediately that makes the child not to be serious about the diversion and actually may lead that child dropping out of the diversion program. So that's why it is important that that order should be very clear that it has to address a particular challenge faced by that child. It is also important for the prosecutor to appreciate that that diversion order has to be taken by the probation officer back to the center timeously, so that that child should start the program promptly, otherwise it loses interest. Now, it means that now if we are not of the same mind, that will not happen, and it impacts directly on the delivery of the diversion program. Again, it is important for the police to appreciate that is a requirement of law that all arrested children, regardless of the crime, how petty it may appear to be assessed by a probation officer. Otherwise, if you just arrest the child and let the child go, in fact, that's one explanation where you find sometimes that our statistics and those of the police, they don't coincide on this issue. Because they let some of these cases go. Without the downside of that, now they don't benefit from the programs that are available. And it is important that they should be arrested so that they are assessed by the probation officer and required by the law. Otherwise, they will fall in the cracks. Well, suffice to say that, of course, there are forums or platforms where these issues are addressed, such as the Child Justice Forum and Case Flow Management Meeting. These issues, they are tabled because, of course, in the course of implementation, there are challenges. Then these issues, they are referred to this forum, and then they are addressed on an ongoing basis. Of course, restorative justice, by and large, practitioners involved in this work, they are not trained in restorative justice. As a doubt, whether they are magistrates or what, or police, they are not necessarily trained in restorative justice. Now, so, which means that the application tends to be uneven. And to address this requires both formal and informal training on an ongoing basis. It requires that orientation programs jointly, that is across the justice cluster, because we're not bringing new cadres on board, we should ensure that they are on the same wavelength, and usually we do this through induction programs. So we are moving now in the direction to ensure that we invite the cluster partners to participate in induction programs, so that they are able to outline clearly what should we expect from police, and both what should we expect from social workers, and what should we expect from the justice system, so that we are on the same wavelength. Yeah, that is how we deal, we engage these issues on an ongoing, ongoing basis. Of course, when people shift, they move, then you face the challenge that it has to be to revisit, to train, etc. Then the policy and legislative framework is very, very comprehensive. To highlight just a few that relate directly to the presentation, the Child Justice Act, the Environment 2008, the Children's Act, the Law of 2005, the Provincial Services Act, and the Constitution. And of course, all other relevant pieces of legislation, they also, in one way or the other, relate to the restorative program. Reunification and reintegration. Well, what is covered here on the slide is what actually we do through transfer budget, what is done by NPOs. They complement the work done by our social workers in the regional offices, who actually do victim offender mediation programs, family group conferencing, victim support services. All that work happens in our regional offices, where they meet the family and do all those activities. What we have sketched here on the presentation is the work we do via NGOs through transfer budget. Basically, their focus is on skills, because when children exit this program, some, they are just about to be above 18, so they are no longer of school going age. And even if they have to be on further education, either they opt to work, so they need skills to access the job market. And of course, it's not always, we'll give them to prepare them. And we have piloted a number of projects through USIBO, where we placed in the Cape Islands about 60 children who were referred by our Stellenbosch office to ensure that they get some training so as to be in a position to be integrated in communities. These skills, they are quite attractive to the market. They involve electricity, they train the electricians, others they are involved in plumbing, forklift, waitressing, and cooking. And this gives the children a sense of empowerment and to move on with their lives, not to revert back to cry, because they feel quite empowered. Well, we try to spread these interventions throughout our regions, with a view, as I've indicated, to complement what our regional offices are actually doing. So we have them in Metro South, in places such as Hanover Park, where Youth Impact and Sustainable Solutions is involved with about 36 candidate the 2017-2018 financial year. The cover such areas as Hannover Park, Mannenberg, Lavender Hill, Mitchell's Plain, and Kukuletu. We know these are areas with high levels of gangsterism, and it is a challenge really to redirect the youth to non-criminal activities. We work with other departments in the anti-gang strategy, for example, to ensure that these services actually were able to render them, because it's not easy. Because to go to some of these areas that are high, that are classified as in fact red zones of crime, is not easy. Even local activists on the ground who are eager and willing to render these services, they face the reality that to actually face these gunshots that are unpredictable is not easy. When we look at transfer funding, USSECO was given an amount of 415,745 in the 2017-2018, and then in 2018-19 we applied to sustain that amount. And Kulisa is the same, and YISSC is the same. And this organization has gone through a rigorous process of assessment, because we do 3-year funding cycle. Now they've been through that process, they were assessed. We checked their non-financial data. We checked they were subjected to our monitoring and evaluation process. We were satisfied that they are delivering the services they are delivering. So there's value for money, and we are continuing supporting them in this financial year. And they are doing good work in terms of ensuring that the youth is integrated. Then what are our constraints? Well, in terms of our constraints, we have got challenges when it comes to human capacity to deliver this service. The aspiration in terms of the Probation Services Act is that probation is a specialized field, is a specialized area. And if we had our way, probation officers should really be focusing on restorative services, on probation work, to assist these children to change their behavior. But this is not always possible to just specialize. Hence we say that there are human resource constraints that are actually constrain our capacity to deepen our intervention in terms of restorative services. The other one, of course, is that although the need for service growing, expansion services is hampered by budgetary constraints. The act is very clear. There's no ambiguity in the act that the Minister of Social Development has to make resources available to do this work. Now, doing this work means when they say that they are delivered in a family context, it means that the child moves from home to an area where the services are delivered, moved house. It means that if the child now, has to find his or her own means to get to the venue where the services are provided, and the venue may be is beyond a radius of 5 kilometers, which is the case. So you cannot just walk to these areas. And the government transport is very limited to actually use cars of social workers to actually fetch these kids. And while they are there, of course, ensure that they get a catering so that they focus on what they do. So these are some of the challenges in terms of budgetary constraints we mentioned. Of course, in terms of the Act, these services, these interventions, especially at reunification, they have to be sustained for a year post-diversion. So it's quite a toll on monitoring. The aspiration of our monitoring plan speaks to 100% monitoring. But because of human capacity, it's not possible to monitor each and every intervention we make. And of course, there's the whole question of textiles. We have seen in other services how, for example, it's very difficult for ambulances to get to their places to attend to people in need because of textiles. And it's not in all instances that staffs are ready to escort people to do this thing. And also it means that also, for example, for home-based supervision, you cannot actually render such services after hours to actually to go out to these places. Now you rely now on the cooperation of parents on whether they are actually, they've got a buy-in in terms of the intervention you are making. Well, all these challenges, they are receiving attention on an ongoing basis. If Prof joins, for example, on anti-gangsterism, is focusing on these issues around the highly prioritized police stations of gangsters that are trying to create safe zones so that service providers are able to move in and deliver their services. But of course we know that crime and violence is not only for these places that are classified as red zones. It happens also in other areas as well, and it's not always possible to attend to those areas. Well, on that note, members, I will just take a pause and allow my colleague to continue. But as I say that this presentation, they actually overlap, they appear there to be seen as integrated presentations. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gamba. I just want to ascertain from members, and I know what I've said before, and I just want to check with you, do you have the urge to ask your questions now on this presentation, or will you wait for the next one? I'll take a cue from you. You can wait. Okay. All right. Then it's over to you. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Gaba did such a good job at defining the two concepts that we discussed today that I just put it in the presentation, but will not take you through it. I think I should focus on my business towards this. The presentation is focusing on restorative justice and family reunification within a centre context. So what are we doing at our child and youth care centres, especially our secure care centres? Just to refresh your memory, in terms of the Child Justice Act, we have 5 centres that accommodate youth in conflict with the law. First one is Busasa Horizon, close to Fora on the N1, you will get it. They are accommodating sentenced and awaiting trial boys, as well as diversion level 2, which Mr. Gaba alluded to. Frelos Elsies Rivier is our girl center for sentenced and awaiting trial girls. Bonnetoon Kraaifontein is accommodating sentenced and awaiting trial boys. Otenikwa and George accommodate sentenced and awaiting trial boys. And Busasa Klein William awaiting trial boys down in the West Coast. Now, on the next page, in terms of the objective, what is restorative justice in our context? Is we learn our young people the ability to gain insight into their behavior. that cause harm to others and to rectify these behaviors while they are in the center, in order to enhance restoration first with the family, then the communities, and then the victim. We find that most of them first have to restore family ties, and we can't move forward just with the victim unless that is restored. Now, how do we do it? In terms of family restoration, the day the child is admitted, they are still part of their nuclear family where they come from. And interesting is more than 70% of our young children that are admitted for, in terms of the Child Justice Act, still have both parents. We expect them to be from single parent households or staying with their grandmas. They may stay with grandma, but they still have both parents that are alive. So we immediately inform them of the child's admission. Some of them didn't even know, although the court process tried to address that during the initial phases. And we inform them about our first review date, which is within 14 days' time, and we invite them to that review date, where we make a plan for that child. So the family starts to be involved right from the beginning. We also recently introduced a contact type of register, where we make sure that the child remains in contact with his family and not his gangsters and those that may bring him some things in. So we check and verify, must identify five people. We check and verify whether they are indeed significant others, whoever that may be. And the social worker is conducting that because that is the initiation of the first restorative process. We also allow or do family mediation where the family members are coming in. And I must say, for a center like Otanikwa, which is quite rural and most families are staying afar, we have the biggest success. Because we also have a little flatlet there, the families come in for a few days and they become part and parcel of that child's plan. If the child is ongoing showing challenges, we also make the family part of that. They don't just hear about it in the future. We also allow family visits every week. There's also contacts in terms of the family, but I will talk about family reunification. A lot of our processes are focusing on the child saying sorry, first gaining insight in what his behavior harmed the family especially, and then saying sorry. And we, one of our therapeutic processes is restorative letters, also to allow controlled family visits with the social worker and or the probation officer. And then also placement and eventual release back into family care. So for us, the family restoration is coming first. Secondly is community restoration. More, I would say, in excess of 95%, our children committed crimes in the community that they come from. And they are the most scared of returning to that community because of retaliation, having to face those people that they harmed. But it's in our communities, it's views you offended not against Rwanda, you offended against us as a community. So it's very important that our children are taught the fact that when they restore, they should do it in a community-related actions. How do we teach them when they sit far from their families or their communities? We, in all our centers, we have active community benefit programs. So whether it's a gardening program, woodwork program, making puzzles and so on for community-based schools or so forth, they have to put something in and give it without expecting something back. So all of our children are involved in community, in programs that would benefit the community in some other way. Go and work at the SPCA, go and work at the old age homes and do their gardens and so forth. And then we also allow them to participate in external sports programs, so that they can become part of community in a positive way. We are now competitors on the sports field, and I'm not always the one that harm you. When we have holiday programs, And that would benefit a local community. What we are doing, so for instance, we have a literacy program during the holiday, spelling bee, we will do it against the community school, and vice versa. And then also holiday leave, where the child gets approval to go back to the community for short-term periods and comes back, and then there's a process that see what was difficult for you, how did you adapt, rather than wait until everything is done, you served your sentence and there you go. Nothing happened in the meantime to restore that child or let it face also the confrontation by the community. Last one is victim restoration. This happens not that often, I must say. The reason for that is victims are not necessarily involved in a therapeutic process on their side. So they're not necessarily prepared to appreciate or willing to have that process from their side. And their participation can't be forced, and therefore it's always with their consent. Where we do find victim restoration very positive is where the offence is in family context. A child abuse case or drug-related case where the family was, things were stolen from the house or so forth, then it's easier to do family restoration, and that is always done with the probation officer that also on that side on the other side assists them. In terms of family reunification, our children can't be locked up and the key thrown away, although a lot of people wish we could do it, including the justice system. I recently visited a rural town and they said, why do you want the children to come back to us? Where else? You know, so we have to put in effort to change the mindset of not only community, as we said, as in the family context, but also into the structures of that community. So family reunification is very important, and bringing that structures on board while we do family reunification. So first of all, when a child enters, there's a telephone call. The family are phoned every week from our centers at the cost of the department. And the child can phone, and we can't get contact, we go look for the people. For us, it's one of the most important things to also stabilize behavior within the centers. We also allow weekly visits, and unfortunately, 50% of our children receive visits from family, which sometimes is very difficult for a child to comprehend. They would accept them for holiday leave but not come and visit. So how do you determine that the child can go on holiday leave if there is no family bond before the time? We also have 6 monthly review panels, so that's one of the ways we address it, with a probation officer physically bring the parents or the family members to the center, and we have review sessions with them. How the child's progressing, what is changing on their side, and how soon can the child be reunified with the family. We also, more often than not, although the child can give permission from a certain age for any medical interventions, we do inform the parents when there's medical permission needed and so forth. And then, of course, there's also mediation sessions between family. We had a child with, for instance, high resistant strain of TB, and the child was approved to go on medical release, but the family refused because he harmed the family. So there was a lot of work that had to go in for them to accept the child back into their family. And then, as I indicated, the type of family contact that we allow. And then the holiday leave is twice a year. The question is asked, why when you have 4 school holidays? Family contact is a therapeutic process. And our children come back very disrupted. They are faced again with the context in which their families are living in. They're faced again with all the things that, you know, the drugs and the gangs and all the things that they have to say no to. and they find it difficult if they are faced with that too frequently. So we must allow for them to visit, sometimes make mistakes, and then take them on a therapeutic path again after that. So in the old industrial school system, they went every quarter, and you always sit with a disrupted child in your system also, because the child is just settled down, then he must go again and he must deal with everything, and you know, so there's no time for healing to take place between this. And then, as you know, we're the only province that introduced the early release system. I've given you the statistics later on in this presentation to show you that we do reap successes. And this is one of the most successful programs that we have. To date, we have three level fours. You see, I said put level three statistics also in. That's the Children in Secure Care in terms of the Children's Act. We apply the same principles. Only three children that was sentenced that were released that came back. It's not to say they don't re-offend. They may re-offend when they turn 18 and become an adult, or they may re-offend when their sentence expires. So we don't have that. And then, of course, we can't make the assumption that every child have a parent or a family to return to. So our independent living programs also get a lot of attention. We have NPOs that specifically caters for that, and we also have a few CYCCs that specialize in independent living programs once a child is released, where to go to them. Story. I've given you the statistics on the early release. So maybe I can go through it. In the first year, and that was in 2014-15 when we introduced that, 42 sentenced youth were released early. It's looking like this at the back. The others is just programs that Mr. Garber just talked about already. And if we look at child justice, we specifically look at level four. And as you can see, as the program settled that year, the releases got more. And we had two children that returned, so the early release were rebuilt because of reoffending or not sticking to the conditions or whatever. In year two, that's 2015-16, 27, level 4s were released. And remember, most of our children are sentenced for 2 years. So you will see a cycle of increase, decrease, increase, decrease. Then in 2016-17, 43 children were released, and we had to revoke one, which was a level 3, a children's act child. And this year so far, without the recent releases of last week, we've released 18 so far on early release. And we revoke one. The program, the support program by probation officers was piloted in Metro North and in the Winelands, and Mr. Gaba spoke to that. And the children in that areas that were early released were introduced into that program. That will now roll out. We said the other day, we're not talking about pilots anymore. That is now a provincial approach, that children that are released will be taken up in programs like that for an extra support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take a round of questions two per member, and then you must just jot down the questions or remember it so that you can respond to it afterwards. So, members, I'm going to start Member Wenger, I know that Member Gopi, Member Lekker, Member McElhaney and Member Gillian. Member Wenger, I'm starting with you.
Thank you, Chair. I will start with the first presentation. The Child Justice Forum was mentioned. Could we have more information on this and how often it meets, what is its mandate, who leads it, who else sits on the forum, etc. And then I just wanted to raise a concern then about the... first of all, check if I understand correctly. A child is referred to the DSD for restorative or reunification services, and the department refers that person then to an NGO, whether that's USICA or CUDISA or YISS. Is that right? Okay, but the reach of these three NGOs is very limited. It's Hanover Park, it's two and the ones, and I'm sure that these reunification services are needed across the province. So how does the department deal with reunification services outside of these three very limited areas?
Thank you. I'm going to take the round and then you'll respond. Can you switch off your mic?
Mine is also on the child justice. Mr. Gaba said that many of them are not trained in the child justice program. Now, my question is, whose task is it to train them on the child justice? And my second question is on the training that is taking place at the centers. Who does the training and how long is the training? And I also noticed that there's only one center for the girls. Now, how do you deal with the shortage of placement centers? What happens to those that doesn't have any space at the center?
Thank you, Member Leka.
No, thank you, Chair. My question is on the offenders that are referred to these institutions that have already been mentioned. Do we have instances where offenders become defiant and unruly whilst they are at the center, and do we have measures of ensuring that those who become defiant or unruly are referred to other institutions which perhaps might be able to assist them or rehabilitate them further? And my question, the second question, Chair, is mainly around issues of families who, it's on the second presentation, families that are not willing to take ownership of those children. What are processes that are in place to ensure that those children are not left vulnerable and that families are eventually, after processes, are able to receive the child back and be integrated into a family kind of environment? I thank you, Chair.
Member Makaleni.
Thank you, Chair. My question, the first one, is on the assessment that the children receive when they arrived in the SOYCC. Then my question would be, what does the assessment entail? And then the second one is, this report speaks up mainly about the children that are in CYCCs. I'm concerned about those children that are not in the CYCCs, like in Portsmouth, and then that are also in the same age as this one. Just want to know if you've got programs for those as well.
Member Gillian.
Thank you, Chairperson. I need to know when the department intend to roll out these programs to other areas in the province, and how do you identify the NGOs that you take up in this program? Then, other question is, how do you rate successes out of this program? And my main concern is after this program. Do you have a program that monitor those children that have been released? And what is the success rate into adulthood? Thank you.
Thank you, Member Mitchell. Is there any questions that you want to pose? Okay. In terms of the numbers that you quote there for Usiku, that's 60 and the 54 for Kulisa, of what number did they come from? You know, what number were they approved from
for the diversion program, and how do you partner with WCED, and what is that partnership? What does that partnership entail between DSD and WCED?
The Child Justice Forum meets on a monthly basis, and is chaired by the NPA. All the departments, by justice, and all the departments in the justice criminal cluster, they actually attend and participate. Basically, it's a forum to converse bottlenecks and operational issues, and find ways of resolving them amicably. Then now, if those issues between, for example, departments, they pose some challenges, they are further, or they've got policy implications, they are referred to the development committee that is chaired by justice, with the head of justice in the province. And then that development committee is represented by the heads of departments. So they are in a position to resolve those issues, and it reports to the National Development Committee, so as to ensure that the issues, they are actually all the transversal issues pertaining to the justice cluster are actually resolved.
Maybe I can add to that. Okay, maybe I can just add to that. When we speak about the justice cluster and the stakeholders, we refer to, in more detail, representatives from SAPS who are involved with children, the assessment of children. We have constant liaison with the NPA. So it's not just about meeting once a month. Relevant issues are discussed, especially it could lead to another question on the movement of children. If children are not moving quickly through the system, it's all addressed in the Child Justice Forum within the ambit of the Child Justice Act. And also somebody said asked about training. This is the forum that identifies the training of other role players who deal with children. For example, the Department of Justice arranges training on the Child Justice Act on a regular basis, which includes all role players. And then SAPS is also controlled by a national body who also ensures training. And this has been a challenge where all new staff in the other stakeholders have not been trained on the Child Justice Act, but it's work in progress. Thank you.
I'm just taking the training question forward. The question specifically was what training is happening in our centers. Let's start with our staff. All staff undergoes legislative as well as operational training during the induction phase when they are appointed, so that they can have an understanding of the legislative framework that they work in, as well as how does it practically be employed in terms of operational standards. In terms of our residents, the type of training our residents receive is formal education, as well as skills development-based training, in terms of therapeutic programs such as offence-specific and offence-related programs. So in terms of the scholastic training, we do, in some centres, follow a dual curriculum in terms of the National Curriculum Framework, which we know as CAPS. And we especially do that also with our girls. We find that they are furthered down the education stream once they admit it. We also follow the Adult Education and Training, the AET program, which makes it easier for our offenders to return to community-based education following release, because they will not necessarily go and sit in a school, community school, with a grade 3 after they've done grade 1, 2 and 3 with us while they are 17, but they more easier will go and integrate in an adult education and training program.
Thank you.
of the goals, Sue?
Okay, in terms of goals, the good news is our goals don't necessarily are sentenced. We only have 5 sentence goals in our centers. During all this period, had 1 from Eden Karoo. The rest are all coming from the city metro area. And we have 38 awaiting trial goals, which all come from the metro area. So the goals, although we would like to extend, we have to say we have 3 or 4, you can see that the need is not for that. The need is more for those that have behavior challenges. So in terms of our availability, in terms of the need, it's spot on. And we are glad our goals are not reoffending. Or offending. In terms of what do we do when there is defiance or unruly behavior, the sad news is the legislation does not allow for us that they be transferred deeper into the system, and deeper into the system is to a prison after they are sentenced. It only allows for us to move them among centers. So that is one of our biggest challenges, because the children know it. You can do nothing. You will just move me to Otaniqua or whatever. What we did do is we've increased the centers that can accommodate sentence youth. So we've also introduced a sentence youth program at Busasa. So now we at least can have 3 of them. Of course, they're not being considered for early release, and they are. We had gone through a difficult period, but it's going exceptionally well currently. Because we work very closely with the NPA as well as Justice, that children that are close to 18, 17 years and 5 months, not be sentenced to serve their sentence amongst these young children that are sometimes 11. So we got excellent cooperation, and therefore we see a stabilization in defiant behavior. We also have rolled out training, emergency response team. We have emergency response team that respond to when incidents occur, so that we not necessarily always have to call in the police, which also have their repercussions, as well as all our staff, except for one center, where we still have to train about 20, have been trained in control and restraint techniques in order to prevent the escalation of incidents as and when they should occur. Okay, in terms of children at Paulsmoor, the good news is there's only 9, which is remarkable. And most of them are awaiting trial, and it's because of the seriousness of the offence and that they're very close to 18. And then the decision by the magistrate was that they are detained. They have a probation officer that visits them daily, and they are involved in the programs that are offered by the Department of Correctional Services. Sorry? And offered by the probation officer. The assessment question?
They're all at the Child and Youth Care Centers, 9. We averaged at about 2 children only in Paulsmoor 2 months ago. So we're doing quite well, because we have a probation officer visiting every week. We've got an NGO that does once a week programs with the children awaiting trial. So we have a constant hand on the children in Paulsmoor, a correctional facility. On occasion, we'll have one in Mossel Bay, but that is sorted out quickly. Some of them land in a correctional facility when they just for a day or two when they're waiting a vacancy in one of our CYCCs. Which we expedite the cases, they are requisitioned to court, and they immediately transfer to one of the CYCCs as soon as there is a vacancy. So they don't stay indeterminately in Paulsmoor, in a correctional facility. We get them out as soon as possible, because it's not a good environment for them to be in. Some of them have to be there because of the very seriousness of the crime, and if you see the stats on Portsmouth, mainly murder, armed robbery, and rape. That's what the kids are there for. And most of them that are there at the moment, it's between 17, 17 and a half, or just before they turn 18. It's very, very seldom that children under 16 and a half, I would say, are referred to Portsmouth. And if it's an overnight thing where sometimes people do make mistakes in terms of thefts and so on, where the child is admitted to Portsmouth wrongly and there is a vacancy, those little challenges we deal with immediately and the child comes back. So for now, at CYCC's and Portsmouth. Minimally in Portsmouth, and the most are in the CYCC's, and others await trial at home. So those are the three options currently available.
Can I just ask, sorry, what is the number of sentence youth in your CYCC's currently?
It's 145. In terms of families, what do we do if they don't get involved? We don't stop. I think that's the bottom line. Because we make them involved from the day the child is entered. We phone them, we tell them, your child is here, we want to make you part of the plan. And therefore, probation officers play a very important role to bring parents to the centers. And therefore, we have scheduled sessions where we review the plan. And we must make the parent part of the success of the children. Remember, they are extremely disappointed. They are ashamed by what their child conducted. They are harmed by what their child conducted. So we must, as we restore the child, we must restore the family member's faith in the child. So that's why we invite them to arts exhibitions, our skills training programs, concerts that we have in our facilities, family days. And as we say, each and every child must phone his family every week. So that it's like potty training. You first have a schedule and then it comes automatically. So we have to make this from a forced relationship to an automatic relationship to a loving relationship. And therefore, holiday leave is also for us very important, and also the follow-up of the holiday leave. What did the parents struggle with? And then empower them in terms of that from the probation officer's side, and from our side is then working on the child once he returns. And as you can see with the successes in terms of the early release, we put the power back into the hands of the family members. There's certain conditions attached. The child must be at home a certain time. He must follow certain rules, and the parent is placed in charge of that. So where there was a skewed power position in the house before that. And we hope that that is part of normalizing a family environment going forward.
I don't know what to say.
Answering some questions?
Yes.
On the type of assessment, it's stipulated in the Act under Section 35. It's a whole range of issues to establish whether the child is in need of care, to estimate the age of the child, to establish whether the child should be placed in a sexual care facility, and also to establish whether the child has actually been infected by an adult who committed a crime. So it's a whole range of issues that are stipulated in the Act, and then they appear on the assessment form of the probation officer, and they have to be implemented in terms of standard operating procedure to get all that information that is required pertaining to the child, and any other relevant information that may assist the development of the child.
No, thank you, Chair. Whilst we are at this presentation on restorative justice, I once read an article where there were employees that were attacked in I think at Bonnie Town Cryfontein. and I think is it Bonitune? Oh, yeah, thank you. So I want to check whether what happened to that incident itself, how did it unfold? Were there any help given or some kind of comfort given to the employees? Also, what happened to the miners that were involved in that kind of attack?
It brings me back. I will first say what happened to the miners, to the challenge that we have that we can't move them to prison. And I think that's sometimes difficult for employees to accept. Because in another environment, if somebody wrong, they're taken away from your face and there they go. So we usually transfer them then to another center of a similar nature, like either Busasa or Ryden or Otaniqua. All the employees that were involved in that incident were engaged with ICAS programs, and some of them are still supported in terms of that. When they return, it takes more or less a year to get them back to where the original incident started. So we first let them do administrative work, then let them do movement management, admissions, until they systematically are engaged. We also, as I said, strengthened the ability to deal with incidents, and it was with interventions by our MEC that we got an agreement with the Department of Correctional Services to assist us with control and restraint techniques. And then, of course, we also looked at the type of uniform we give our staff in order to have their keys more safeguarded, their radio, because we have nothing else. We can't equip them with batons or whatever. So more safer shoes for them to wear, so that when there's broken glass, their foot doesn't get injured or they don't slip in the process of doing control and restraint and so forth. So we've looked at that at a holistic approach. And then I think it was previously reported that the Department of Transport and Public Works has awarded 64 million for the emergency upgrades in our centers to specifically address security and emergency measures. And as I speak now, a fence of 14 million is erected around Bonitune. Because many moons back, it was an old hotel. So you can understand that it was not purpose-built. And also to strengthen security measures at our other security centers. We're about halfway through with Otaniqua. Bonitune is receiving attention, as well as there's a new unit being built at Glen William and so forth. So it's not one approach, it's a holistic approach to such incidents. And we didn't see recent incidents because I think, you know, staff are more confident also to deal with that.
You can follow up, and then Member Gopi and Member Wing, your questions were not answered. Okay, shall we deal with that first, and then we'll go to the follow-ups, Member Lekker?
Okay. After release, as we indicated, the probation officers play an important role, and then they are engaged in the programs that Rueda will speak about that we procure from our NPO organizations, such as NICRO and so forth. And although they were pilots for extended type of interventions in certain areas, it's across the province that service is rendered, as well as our probation officers. If you read on the task, what is a probation officer, they must take ownership of that child. We also have, as I said, children that doesn't have families to return to, and therefore independent living is for us very important. How do I live independently without going back to crime? And that is job-related. Unfortunately, after their court order expires, there's very little we can do from a center
by side. And there the support services from Restorative Justice Program is then rendered, which Ruwaida can allude to. Maybe I can just touch on the Western Cape education. We have an MOU with them where we employ the teachers and render the curriculum, and they render the necessary curriculum oversight and support.
Okay, I think the next question, Mr. Gaba, I don't know if you want to answer this, how do you identify...
Gillian, were you happy now with your...
I'm answering your question, identifying an NPO. You want to answer, okay.
Can you just switch off your mic when that one
comes? Well, we have just come from the beginning of a three-year funding cycle. What we do, we issue out what we call a call for proposal, which is published in the newspapers that are available, the mainstream newspapers. And we invite in fact, let me start, we first identify what we call a gap analysis. In other words, we ask our regional offices, what services they are not in a position to render because of capacity constraints. Then now they will direct us that they need certain services. It could be after-hour services, a number of issues. Then we issue now that call for proposals, and of course guided by the norms and standards of our programs. Then we invite them to apply, we give them a certain period, then they respond. Then we send our M&E team to their facilities to monitor two issues. Governance issues, to see that do they have a board, a structure, do they have a constitution, do they have a business plan, and also do they have the facilities where they will actually operate. Do they have a track? Do they have a track record of delivering those services? What are their finances? Who else is funding them? So we check all those issues, and then I get feedback, and then we score them. And then now, after that, the program assesses their business plan. And then now we make a submission to the chief directorate, the SOD, and the minister. Then they approve. That is done across board. And then after we contract with the funding grid is approved, we then now enter into what we call a transfer payment agreement with them. Then that is done with consultation with them, and then we agree that this is what we request them to do, and then they agree to deliver those services. We have stakeholder engagement to say that, okay, these are the norms, these are the reporting period, then this is how we will get the reports from you. And then this is what we need to do to ensure that the agreement is sustained. For example, they need to submit annual financial statements at the end of the year. They need to report to the head office in terms of their NPO status, etc. And then during the period, we will monitor whether they are actually adhering to the TPA. And then they report on a quarterly basis. We basically partner with them to deliver the services.
Chairperson, I think I'm really not answered. I've asked a question to the department. How do you define your success rate? I don't get an answer on that one. And then the other question about the programs after release, how do you monitor these children? It's not answered, Chairperson.
On your mic while you get there.
services procured from an, you're talking about success rate of the NGOs that we fund? Have I got it right?
Talking about the success rate of the program. How do you define your success rate?
Okay. Thank you.
Let me answer that. Our success, we define it in terms of whether we have achieved our annual performance targets. And then whether we also have a clean audit report from the Auditor General in terms of our non-financial data performance management. For example, if we say that we are contracting this organization to secure these services, these are the norms and standards they have to adhere to. We have our monitoring team, they check that, and all that is in place. Then we can say, we can answer the question, has there been value for money? You can say, yes, there has been a value for money, because we have achieved what we set out to achieve. We have achieved in terms of the norms and standards. We have monitored, and we know that it is effective. So that is our success rate in terms of our program, and that is in the annual report. So it's the annual report that fully answers the question whether our programs have actually delivered. Now we're talking now at the program level. And that's where our APP outputs are. Because you'll find that is those annual performance targets, they are linked to the budget that has been voted and approved. And then we demonstrate that this is how we have applied. And then we demonstrate that then the audit confirms or rejects it, that we have not achieved it. So that is verifiable whether we have succeeded.
Maybe I can extend that, and because I think what the member wants to know is how do we monitor those that we release, and what is our success rate. As I said, each and every child are released with conditions, and those conditions is monitored by the probation officer together with the family of that child in whose care the child is released into. I've also indicated how many children return back because of the breaking of that conditions. And over the, since 2014, since the inception of this program, only 3 returned while under the conditions. And that is the only figures we have. Once a child's sentence expires, we have no right to interfere in his life anymore. We can offer programs which he voluntarily partakes into, but I can't keep on getting to your house and messing in your life after your sentence expires. So that's how we monitor. We press conditions, the probation officer together with the family, we get progress report, but on a certain cutoff date, on expiry of sentence, he gets a 175, which is discharged from the act, and after that, we can't do anything anymore.
Member Gillian.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I have not answered. When I talk about success, I don't talk about your annual report. I don't talk about your financial audit. I talk about the outcome of your aims and objectives of the program. That's what I want to know. Yeah, but I mean, to get an answer on annual report, financial viability, yeah. That's not the answer.
Yeah.
Because your success rate is,
yeah,
in social development needs to be measured. What have I done right in the life of that child? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Member Leka.
Thank you, Chair. My follow-up on the question that I asked previously would be, seeing that those employees were injured on duty, was there any form of compensation offered to those employees because they were injured on duty?
Member Gopi?
My other question that I still had outstanding, it was on the page, the one with the quarter level 3, level 4, level 5. I want to know what is the meaning of these levels. What do they stand for?
Member Winger? Thanks, Chair. I have two questions on the second presentation. Also, on the early release program, it appears that the total number of orders issued seems to be in a negative trend, i.e. the total numbers sort of declining. So I just want to know if that's something to be concerned about or something that can be taken to your partners in justice. And then the second question is just for clarity on page 17. I'm not quite sure. Under constraints it says legislative omitted you parole in legislation. I'm not quite sure what that means. Thank you.
Member Makaleni and Member Killian.
Thank you. My two questions in this round, Chair, will be on what are the reasons for the release of parole to be revoked on the ones that you've identified in this presentation. And then also, what are the alternative placements do you send the children to when it is not safe for them to go to their biological families or communities? So what are the alternatives you...
Member Gillian.
Thank you, my chairman. I think I did not get an answer on the issue of the rollout throughout this province. There is one in Fora, one in Yeltsin River, one in Tryfontein, one in George, and one in Glen William. What are your plans for other regions? Or is it not a need?
Okay. Also, within the diversion program that you have, and not in secure care, but in communities that you have your presentation, is it customized for the individual that is undergoing this program, or is it a one size fits all program, or can you customize it within the objectives of the program, and what are the rules of engagement per individual who undergoes this program, and the timeline, and is there second chances if, you know, the first time it has not succeeded, and has there been sentences overturned for individuals because of this kind of program?
In terms of a staff member that gets injured, injury on duty is the process to follow. So immediately they get registered as a person that will be dealt with in terms of that process. So all hospital contacts, all psychological support, everything following that is paid through that program. So that the medical aid nor themselves incur the cost. In terms of the levels of care, I think I previously made a presentation about the levels of care within alternative care within the department. Now, level 1 care is within a family. Level 2 care is in terms of children that are dealt with in terms of the Children's Act, but is placed in community-based residential care, inclusive of the old children's homes. But it can also be foster care. Level 3 care is a child that display behavior that cannot be managed and controlled by their parents, or that have become in contact with criminal activities but has not been dealt with in terms of the Child Justice Act. That's our old schools of industries, which we call level 3 secure care. And we follow also their early release system. It's more or less the same type of process, of early discharge system. Where we want to motivate them to move from external locus of control to internal locus of control where they can be manage their behavior. And level 4 care is for children that are dealt with in terms of the Child Justice Act who are either awaiting trial or sentence. Now, the early release system only applies to sentence youth in terms of that level. Just to answer in terms of if there's a negative trend in terms of early release,
the answer is no. If you look at our population of 145, and the average sentence is in 2 years, they get considered on half of sentence. So we sort of initially, when we had children past that sentence already, so there was a bulk that we've dealt with initially, but now it's they're getting in a rhythm. So we will see every 2 year cycle a slight increase of those that were originally now, you know, passed through that, but it's more or less average in terms of that. In terms of revoked, why do we revoke? The three that were revoked was because they became involved with drugs. And they get tested. And first you give them a chance. And the second time when it becomes a pattern, it gets revoked. They come back to the center and they get considered on 3/4 of their sentence again. Okay? Because that's one of the conditions. No drug involvement, attendance to school or work, and they have sort of a curfew and so on. They must also participate in programs that the probation officer do. Alternative placements when it's not safe into the family. As I said, we have independent living programs across the province where children then go and live within this program context, and they work or attend school, and they get cared for until they voluntarily leave or their behavior is of such a state that they are asked to leave. I don't have statistics about why they leave. Then in terms of the rollout of CYCCs, we have currently placements. Our sentence youth is not overpopulated. The demand and the provision is more or less the same. But the need for children on the level 3 level of care is increasing. Children become more difficult younger in life. And the interventions on that is increasing, and of course it will have a roll-on effect with the waiting trial and entering into the justice system. So together with Department of Public Works, a full assessment for 18 months was done to determine what is there and what is the demand and how can it be met. And that report has been provided by the Department of Public Works, and we actively participated in that. For new centres or expansion to current centres and so forth. And the funding need is in excess of 500 million. So a decision on funding still needs to be made. But as I said, we are currently, the first soils have been spit at Glen William to expand in the West Coast the provision of that. So at least in the main regions like the Metro, West Coast and Eden Karoo, there is centres. But I personally went to look into what is the demand for centres in the Middle Karoo, like Beaufort West, Marysburg and so on. It's extremely low. It's about 5 per year. So to put up a facility at the cost of 333,000 per year per child without the building having been built is just not cost-effective. Yeah, Bonnytoon is provided there in that area, and as I say, this is sufficient provision for the. It falls under Winelands currently. There was a fight, but now it falls under Winelands. Yeah, it's on the border. We had a meeting with the municipality. For municipal services, we go to Stellenbosch. For police services, we go to Kraaifontein. So it's on the border. And most of the children that are accommodated at Bonnytoon comes from the Winelands. Yeah. But there's not, as I said, there's a need, and the need has been determined. The fact is now to allocate the funding of 500 million to address that need. So there was a full study being done by consultants. In terms of customization of programs.
Just on to the other one.
on the one way.
Okay. Mr. Garber, can I speak to the pilot router?
Just switch off, Ms. Horton.
There was a question on how do we roll out the pilot and how do we measure the success rate of the pilot. I think the process has been addressed about the processes we use to measure success and whether these pilots will be rolled out. Yes, they will be rolled out, but when we procure pilots, it is procured on a gap analysis in the region. When the pilot is successful, we will roll it out and based on the success rate of the pilot. A pilot is only a pilot while you are still wondering whether the program works or not. We have ascertained that these pilot programs do work. We actually, to highlight the success of one of our programs of reintegration in Hanover Park, we will have a function for these, the actual beneficiaries of the service. One must actually see the beneficiary to say this program is a success. So we want to arrange a function where the actual beneficiaries relate their successes themselves of the program and not what we say in a report. And that will be rolled out. We've had two. And I know the previous question was, we only refer to a few NGOs in certain areas and not all the areas. That is where our regional offices identify a gap in their service where they do not have the capacity to render that service themselves. We cannot procure in the whole province if the regional offices tell us, but they don't have a gap in their service, they are able to render the service themselves. And I hope that answers that. Because we have a process in place in terms of your rate of success to measure that. We do roll out the pilots once they are successful, and NGOs are funded where there is a gap analysis in a particular region. Any further questions? All right. In terms of the diversion program, somebody asked us, ma'am, you asked whether they are a one-size-fits-all. No, they're not. We have, at the moment, I think 9 accredited diversion programs for, depending on the need of the child that's being diverted, the child will come in for a life skills program or substance abuse program. So there are different programs which speak to the needs of that child. Every child doesn't get the same program. It's related to the crime and the needs of the child, and that is ascertained by the assessment of the child. If the child is assessed and we find there is a substance abuse program, a problem with that child that's being diverted out of the child justice system and committed the crime because of his abuse of substance, there's a specific program for substance abuse, for an example, that that child will go to. Does that answer that question? Thank you.
Member Makaleni, I just want to check, in terms of the assessment when a youth comes into secure care, and I am referring to the sexual orientation of that young person, how do you make provision, or is there provision made in the youth care centres for that person in terms of his or her sexual orientation? Member Makaleni?
Chair, I want to understand. More or less, per child youth care centre, there should be not more than 50 children. Am I correct? Okay. I think it's about 35, 30-something. if my memory still serves me. Anyway, my question wants to understand, if there's less than 50 children offenders in the child, so I say, how do we get these drugs? How does these drugs enter the system without being detected? And yet there are so many children that come in and out and that are actually there. It just plays out in my mind. I'm trying to understand. You just used a huge figure now of 500 million that we need in order to establish a CYSC. It just again played in my mind trying to understand. Is it the best way that government can spend its money in rehabilitating these children? So in terms of what we're giving these children and how they come out after the system and the amount that we are spending in ensuring that they become better people to the society. Maybe my last question or concern is the fact that in all the CYCs that we went to, there is not enough material to train these children and to make them better people at the end of the day when they leave the CYCC. And how to address this? Because for me, I found out that we are wasting money unnecessarily keeping those children there when they are not empowered to be better people. Because that means the only thing that they can do is to repeat the cycle again, because they have not gained any skill or anything much to empower them into better people.
That's exactly my question. I really want diplomacy for in self, you know what I'm way Afrikaans, Platelands Afrikaans, that miljoene rande worden hierdie program gespandeer. And I can't get an answer that it's worth it. Because it's a 4 year. This program is running for 4 years already. Am I right? You said since 2014. Oh, it's early.
Only the
early. But it's there for longer. You see, Jefferson, wanneer het kom by kinders, en wanneer het kom by geld mors, is het een van die programme waar geld gemors word. Sorry dat ek so frank en open is. Because this is children that is in conflict with the law. This is children that were supposed to be in programs before going into conflict with the law. And that is my negativeness. That we are prepared to spend millions and millions and millions of rand to keep these children in conflict with the law into a program that cost us 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I can't, if you go into the APP, just look at the millions that's been spent. At the same department that is supposed to spend money on preventing programs that will prevent this. I can't justify this. Now my question is, and I'm still didn't get an answer. I need the department to come back with an answer. And the success rate of this program vis-a-vis the millions of budgets that's been spent in this program. I need an answer on that. And I think the department must come and give us that answer later. Thank you.
Maybe just to latch on, in terms of the diversion programs before you get to in conflict with the law, né? That's how you end up in a CYCC, because you are in conflict, you commit the crime, and then that follows. So the budget versus the diversion outside still, and when you are in a CYCC. So maybe we should look at that. And then the numbers that you quote here, the 60 in, the 54 in Kulika and the 60 in Usiko, ne? What was the numbers in the previous financial year? And what was the numbers who, by your measure, successfully completed? Thank you.
In terms of sexual orientation, it's a self-declaration process we follow. We don't specifically go and ask, what is your sexual orientation? To date, we have two transgender children which were accommodated. The one actually was accommodated in the gender center that they identify with.
which also have legislative risk regarding that, and the other one preferred to be accommodated with amongst boys, where we had the option of a single room. So it's a self-declaration process. In terms of the total number in our centres, the norms and standards give a guiding total of 60 for our level 2 NPO CYCCs. But in terms of our own centres, I previously presented to the committee that we follow a multi-program model. So today I report only on those in terms of conflict with the law. But in our centres we also have level 3 children, we also have substance abuse specific referrals and so forth. So our numbers differs between 60 as well as 195, depending on which centre. In terms of the drugs that you referred to, maybe you misunderstood what I reported on. The question was, how do we determine who doesn't stick to the early release conditions and who goes back? So that drug usage was while at the family. Okay, no, but I can answer the rest also.
When we were in Bonitone, we arrived a week after there was a raid, and there were drugs that were found.
In terms of every child is searched in terms of a guideline on admissions. Unfortunately, some of the children store their drugs in their bodily orifice. I don't want to get explicit, but they hide it, and then it comes out through natural processes of the body, and then it's available.
How did it get?
They put it up.
No, I don't talk about, I know about what they do, whatever. And my question is, how did it get into the centre?
They entered the centre with it up. We can't go and do a lot of, already? At the police or at their families and so forth. So that's the first point. The second point is that we conduct daily, weekly, last night was an unannounced search at the centres to also search for things, because children have a whole day to create things like making a weapon or collecting stuff, and our staff is busy with a lot of other things also during the day. So that is also regularly done, and then we do get the odd occasion where family smuggles it in during visits, and especially the mothers in their underwear and so forth. And we lay criminal charges at that point against that family member, because we will have to show that we are strong and serious about that. And then, of course, there is the odd staff member and or security guard that do smuggle it in. And a few of them lost their jobs as a result. In terms of the type of programs, you all visited Bonitune on, I think, two occasions already. And you saw that we have a full school, we have skills development programs which included plumbing, woodwork, there was also... I don't recall such a report to me that it was no material, because it's part of our annual budget to buy the material. I'm sorry, if maybe you can refer me to an incident, then I can recall that.
Exactly, the day we were there, the woodwork did not have the material, and the steel program, they didn't have the material to continue to do the material. So they showed us old work that they've done already, because there was no material, and they said they are struggling to get material. So I'm surprised that you don't have that kind of information, because that gives me more concern. Because if you don't know, now where is it reported, and when is it done?
The process, we have a budget, and program material is part of that. At that point in time, it was maybe on their way to be delivered or so forth. So that's all I can say about that.
Is the programs now, are the materials there? Are they, if we go to Bonitown tomorrow, they would be busy with what they're supposed to be busy with the materials?
Yeah, the only thing is our woodwork. Educator just resigned, so we are on the point of appointing another one. In terms, but the material is there. In terms of other type of programs, I reported only on the early release. And the early release is supposed to show you the success that we achieve. These children will in other provinces sit for the duration of their sentence without having the option to go. The fact that we have the ability to have children that qualify for early release show the progress that they have made within the centers while they were being there. And therefore, that should at least be a positive for you to show that, that this is working. We offer a range of programs, therapeutic as well as developmental programs. I can also report to you on the numbers of people that go through the programs, if I that would put you out at ease. In terms of diversion, I'm not sure.
If we got your question right, for 2017-18, the people who were referred to diversion, there were 2,939. And then the completion, those who completed, they were 1,175. Oh, so that is 1,413. That is the completed.
Just say that again. It was
2,939. 2,939.
Yeah. And
then completed is 1,413, which is 48%.
So that is for the 17, 18. So that completed now, 31st March.
Selena Martin, Head of Media and Research for the Majority Party.
Thank you very much. Our questions to this presentation. Thank you very much for the department for the presentations, and thank you to members for the robust engagement with the department. I believe that there is refreshments in the lobby, so you can help yourselves to it. Members, we're just going to conclude our administrative task, and then we can also move to the lobby. Thank you. Thank you, Department. I'm going to hurry the department along. Thank you. Thank you.
can take us through, if we have any recommendations, take us through it, please.
Okay, Chairperson, it's only one. The department has come and briefed the committee on the success rate of the diversion program in CYCC versus the budget allocation, outlining the impact of the program to the
chair. And I think we don't have to ask the department to come and present. We can ask them to give it to us in writing.
Okay.
I want to also then recommend that we follow this presentation to one of these NGOs that are listed. Mm. So I'll take the guidance from you as to which one.
Firstly, my apologies for in and out of the meeting. I had hiccups and I didn't want to annoy the two members. And eventually, Member Wing told me what to do with my head down and it worked. Okay, so it wasn't that I... Yes, so my apologies. Chair, I know that sometime we're going to go on this cluster week, but I think we need to somehow work in one of these as one of our...
We
have Vleermet Eat Club.
But now I think the cluster week and the proposals on the table is the Centrale Karoo and the Weskus. And we can work in Hanover Park in one of our as one of our sessions. We don't have to wait for cluster visit week, so we can. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. It's in July, the last week, sometime in July. I think it's the last week in July. Yeah, the cluster week, right? No, we're talking about the cluster week when Mitchell was asking about the cluster week. So, yeah, but we can do that soon. And we don't have to wait too long to do that. Yeah. Okay, if that is in the recommendations, that is it, then we need to go to also the agenda. So you have received the committee report in front of you dated 10 April. And that is on our visit to the oversight visit to Ikam Balavantu. We have a page 2 and then there's a page 3 if you have gone through it. It's only page 2 and 3, that's the contents of it. Member Lekker.
Thank you, Chair. My one concern when we, it's not about the support, when we visited Ikam Balabantu, I felt like we were disrespected by whoever is running Ikam Balabantu because none of them were there only to get Mrs. Sigasana to do the presentation and no one else. And I'm worried. It seems as if either the department did not take our visit serious or whoever is in charge there did not take us serious. Because when we went to the one in Salt River or Woodstock, there were senior persons there. So why that kind of communication? I want us to write a letter demanding an instruction because Mrs. Kasana explained that she only got a notice 2 days before or something. So why are we being disrespected by the department for that matter?
I remember saying that, and maybe we should change just as I say that the committee noted with concern that senior management were not present for that visit. Because the social worker attached to the program was present that day. Member Mitchell, you want to change?
I want to change. I remember. I think we were in the bus or outside when I said if it wasn't for that woman, we would have gone all guns blazing because of her passion. So I just think it's important that we acknowledge the good work that she is doing.
Mm. Okay, so I'll write a letter to Kamvalabantu stating exactly that, but then also noting the concern regarding the senior management that was not present of the department, and noting that the social worker attached to that program was present. Members, if that can I have a mover and a shaker with
mover.
Okay, Member Lacker, Member Mitchell. Then we have an in-house. Let me say, I'm saying in-house. Mm-hmm. Remember, we discussed the time, the starting time for this committee. Okay. So it's not going to change on the parliament program. That stays. We have an in-house arrangement for nine. Okay. All right. But now, before you say thank you, you're going to scold me now before you say thank you. Now, next week we have the Department of Health, the 3 slot. And we have the 2-hour slot next week.
No.
The 4-hour slot. So next week, can we then say that next week we are going to start at 9? Okay, until 1, that is our slot. Then, the following week, there are five presentations will be the social development slot. So I am then, because there are so much on the program, it's also a 4-hour slot, that we then rather to accommodate all the organizations that will be here, we are going to start at 8:30 instead of 9, because I'm just cautious that we are not going to get through all the presentations. Mm-hmm. So the 29th, we are going to start at 8:30. Ne? The 22nd, which is next week, we will start then at 9 o'clock. And I'm sure it's going to be committee room. It's not 8:30, I suppose. Yes. Member Mitchell? Okay, so was it not that like that before? Was it 10:30 before?
Yeah,
oh. Okay, so we can give them the time. Then the Monday just needs to communicate to Nareen in terms of the programming, the time slots. So we're saying the 22nd, we're going to start at 9, and then 29th we'll start at 8:30. And we'll, as we go along, we'll just, whatever is on the program, we will. But we can, in-house, we have an arrangement now that we will start this committee at 9 on a Tuesday morning. Mm. So it will give us a bit of time on
the program. The times must be in the program. That's
a on the program, when we communicate to whoever sets up the program, we say this is the time that we are going to start. So on the 22nd, we are going to start at 9.
Jefferson, please, if you bear with me, I just need to bring under this committee's attention that I am struggling with the city of Cape Town with ECD centers. I've sent communication to the MEC and the HOD's office already. The one center is struggling with the city of Cape Town in and out of court, has passed everything. Alles is goedgekeurd, een beheerman wat een bezwaar aangeteken het. Net een beerman, volgens mij kan het geoverrijd worden. Daar is 150 kinders wat op die straat gaan zitten. by the end of Sunday month. And it is now, I'm now fed up with the city of Cape Town. I don't know what to do next.
What did the HOD or the department come back?
Came back to me, and I'm not satisfied with that answer, because you can't tell this woman to go back and reapply in say circle. Alles.
Don't you want to send me that communication? You can send it via Namonda, she can then, and then maybe you and I should just sit and see what
because apparently the church has now given up until the end of this month, otherwise they will not accommodate her any further, because she has lost income. It's in Kudut. We were there. She has lost income for the last 6 months, which means her rent is behind, all because of een onnodige man. 150 kinders en iets in die 20 werkers gaan sonder werk sit by die einde van die maand.
Nou is het bierman langs waar haar centrum is?
Maar daar is ander goed. Ek kan al die informatie, al die documentatie vir jou gee. Nee, dit is een ingang en een uitgang, als alles. Kinders, ons het een vergadering gehad met die ouders, die kinders speel met gebaren, daar wordt eens geraasie. Kinders het daar gespeeld terwijl ons niet. Maar daar is een groter probleem, binnen die city of Cape Town, die persoon wat verantwoordelijk is, het lijkt daar is een inside thingy, behind the scenes. But I'll send everything. Ek kan nie toelaat dat hy kinders op die straat sit.
Stuur vir my alle goed en dan kyk ons hoe ons kan aanspreek. Dankie dat jy dit onder ons aanloop. Members, I hope they still tea and coffee outside. There's baie koud in die lokaal. Thank you very much for your availability. The meeting is adjourned.
PMG Parliamentary Monitoring
Committee.
Siyaqala ulanduka ukhavarisha i-provincial legislator kulonyaka. Umthetho wethu from 97 sikhavarisha u-parliament.
So nizaba lapha for how long?
No so far sisakhavarisha 6 committee meeting.
Okay, so nijonga nje.
So siya monitorisha then sibhala report.
Monitorisha ndona.
Pro ilantu proceeding like a meeting. Then separate report.
Let me send you to Nepal.
No. What are the questions about?
Oh, it's just no responses.
Yeah, no responses.
That's
it's detailed, but what detailed response? I respond like copper newspaper.
Yeah.
Just say like what detailed.
Okay. Like, so, and then which one are is that this engagement?
No, like separate report. It's full.
Sure, I'll talk about reports. You don't need to
know. Okay, the discussion. Discussion. Sorry, you can't remember, I apologize, isn't it?
Uh-uh.
Okay, what?
There's a corner,
boss. Okay.